My name is Greg Felton. I grew up in the 19, I guess the, throughout the 1980s, I had no real direction, and I sort of fell into journalism because I wrote a rather snarky piece about Christmas, and the newspaper where I live published it. So I found a calling writing my opinions and doing reporting.
Well, that's nice. In the 1980s, it was actually possible in the 70s and 80s, maybe 60s even, for almost anybody to get a piece into a local newspaper. And but slowly it's been. So whereabouts was that? And, you know, what, you know, give us an idea of where you are, too.
Well, that was in Vancouver, British Columbia. I remember before the Pacific Press, which publishes the Siamese Twins of Stupidity, the Vancouver Sun and Province, was on Granville Street at 6th Avenue. And I remember I walked into the office, walked into the building, which was a very squat, gray building, not attractive at all. And I spoke to the editrix of the section I was writing for. Like, I could actually talk to people. It was quite interesting because since then, since the Sun and Province have moved down to the foot of Granville in downtown Vancouver, it's like walking into Checkpoint Charlie. It's very inhuman, very, very unwelcoming. I mean, you don't talk to people, that you have to call them down. This is what happens at the CBC, the Globe and Mail. The reporters are now almost hermetically sealed off from the public. It's like osmosis. Reverse. You know, they issue information or propaganda, but they don't allow anything from the public to get into them. So it's a very weird scenario. I mean, there's no real relationship between the press and the public. At any rate, I wrote my piece back in 1989, I think. And since I got paid $250 for it, I thought, geez, I can get money writing my own opinions. So I thought, this is great stuff. And so I wrote a few more, and of the four pieces I wrote, three ended up getting published. So I figured this is something I really could do. So I went to journalism school, got a certificate in journalism, and tried to make a living at it until the World Trade Center was subjected to a nuclear attack, and everything was blamed on the Muslims, and all hell broke loose, and journalism really betrayed itself as a medium for prostitutes. I couldn't really be a journalist anymore, so I ended up going into teaching English, which is pretty much how I make my living now. And I do speak Chinese, Russian, French, German, and a few others, so I do have a good rapport with my students.
Yeah, I mean, we'd be nice to talk about you know, what's been going on this last week, particularly yeah. in Palestine. I still call it Palestine, Palestine, Israel, anyway. But we can't really talk to a Canadian without mentioning this. I think, isn't it called Nazigate, Trudeau Gate, or whatever? The amazing phenomenon of the entire Canadian Parliament giving a standing ovation to a former SS sergeant. Who was personally responsible for war crimes in the Second World War as he was fighting the Russians. But, I mean, it's an extraordinary phenomenon. And then a very, very hasty apology by Trudeau and the sacking of the Speaker. I mean, how on earth
The Speaker wasn't sacked. The Speaker stepped down. You can't fire the Speaker unless it's a vote of non-confidence.
Someone may have had a word in his ear.
Yeah, I think he realized that he'd crossed the Rubicon and couldn't go back. And so,
yeah, so can you just take us through that whole business? I mean, it's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. But if you've ever watched Bugs Bunny cartoons, you ever see someone like Yosemite Sam get a cigar, Bugs Bunny lights it, and all of a sudden, boom, it blows up in his face. You know, that's the kind of stupidity that we saw here. The thing of it is, you see, Canada is so very much in the pocket of Israel and the United States, or Israel-America, as I call it, that Canada doesn't really have the wherewithal to think for itself. If America says boycott a country, Canada boycotts it. If America says support Ukraine, Canada supports it. And Canada is just too afraid, literally afraid, to stand up to the Israel lobby. And I know this for a fact because it was told to me by somebody who knew Paul Martin, former prime minister and former finance minister throughout the 90s, who lived in deathly fear of the Israel lobby. That's how much intimidation goes on in Canada, and I'm quite sure it goes on in other countries as well, like Britain and Germany, which used to be a strong country.
What's behind the fear, though?
Well, the fear is you don't want to be called an anti-Semite, which is a nonsense epithet. You don't want your funding cut for your campaigns. You don't want negative press smearing you as an anti-Semite. It's just not worth the effort. So people are afraid of the power of the Israel lobby to demonize somebody and ruin someone's reputation. What's worse, somebody could end up dead. Now, I don't think that's happened in Canada, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I do know for a fact there was a Zionist named Finkelstein, not like the good man Norman Finkelstein, somebody else, who came over to Canada in 1972 to smear the name of Ed Broadbent, who was the head of the New Democratic Party here, which is kind of like left of center. And in 1972-73, it looked like it had a half-assed chance of forming government. It was very popular. So in order to scare the bejesus out of the Canadian public that, if you elect this man, you'll have socialism, you'll have Soviet-style control, blah, 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 blah. Well, the smear campaign worked. So the Israeli government interferes to such an amazing degree in Canadian politics. It's not even felt. It's just part of the furniture. Now, in the case of this ridiculous scenario in Parliament, Canada's knee-jerk click-the-heels support for Ukraine is so automatic that no real thought goes into it. This is like a conditioned reflex. So when someone mentions, hey, there's this Ukrainian guy, 70, 90, whatever odd years old, why don't we honor him in Parliament? Hey, great idea. I mean, nobody bothers to check, because it's not considered necessary. This is such an automatic conditioned reflex that people just went ahead and did it. And then the cigar blows up in their face. Oh, by the way, this is a Nazi who tortured or was responsible for the death of so many citizens of Europe, whatever. And that's when the shit hit the fan, because Trudeau and the speaker. Now, this was a person in the speaker's own constituency. The speaker knew this person or knew of him. Now, why he didn't do a proper background check, I don't know. But when you're
or any background check at all.
Exactly.
I mean, the guy had his own blog where he was quite open about serving in the Galicia SS division. I mean, you know, there's no background check at all has been done here. Or maybe the whole thing was deliberate.
No, I don't think so. I mean, Trudeau is not that smart. And Trudeau is like, he has got so many problems, it is impossible for his government to survive the next election. But to get back to this just shows how having a government of idiots, of unthinking, robotic servants to foreign powers, ruins the reputation of a country. I used to be proud to be a Canadian because, A, I was not American, I was better educated, and my country had a good reputation around the world, especially in the Netherlands. Right now, Canada is one of the world's laughingstocks. It kidnapped Meng Wanzhou, the CFO of Huawei, under the orders, effectively, of the United States, which amounted to kidnapping under the cover of law. Trudeau was afraid to say no. He couldn't say no to the U.S., even though the U.S. had no legitimate right, it had no arrest warrant, it had no bill of indictment, nothing, no extradition request, nothing on paper.
But look, I mean, let's be fair to Canadians, Greg, because what we're seeing in the media and the parliament is not Canada, is it, really?
No, it's quite true. That is right. It is not Canada. However, Canadians used to have a better understanding of themselves. I mean, Canadians, I don't think, feel as good about their country as they used to. And I'm going to say that, I'm going to make that claim. I could be wrong, and I'm prepared to be corrected on that. But I just don't think Canada has the reputation it once had.
How did this Nazi business go down, do you think, amongst the general population there?
I think a lot of people were just ashamed that Trudeau, the speaker, could be so careless. I think a lot of them just attributed it to rank stupidity. I don't think anybody genuinely believed that Canada would willingly, honor a Nazi. They just wrote it off to, this is just another goof. Now, Trudeau has had so many goofs. The Meng Wanzhou one is one. Appointing a native, an Aboriginal person, to be both Attorney General and Justice Minister, who had no qualifications for the job, apart from 2 years as a prosecutor. And she was a complete clusterfuck. She alienated everybody else in the cabinet. She was a dogmatic, pushy, she was horrible. And she was incompetent. And that was one of the biggest scandals that Trudeau faced. And he was found to have been in violation of ethics. And then we have the problem with the Nazis.
What happened with her?
Well, she ended up resigning. Mm. And she went off and wrote a book and sort of patted herself on the back. But nobody really cares. The point is that Trudeau has had one blunder after another. It's like Wile E. Coyote stepping on the rakes that are upturned, you know? Steps on one. He just keeps stepping on the same rakes.
Yeah, well, can you say something, though, about the connections between Canada and Ukraine? Because I know that Chrystia Freeland, the foreign secretary or foreign minister, is very close to the whole Ukrainian. I had no idea that Canada had this Ukrainian community.
Well, we do have, especially in Alberta. Alberta has a strong Ukrainian community. Oh, and by the way, just as a matter of trivia, it was only the Ukrainians in Alberta back in the early 1970s, late 60s, that showed any support for Canada's multiculturalism policy. The rest of the peoples who weren't of a British or French heritage thought it was shameless pandering and tokenism. So the Ukrainians were the only ones who liked it. Now, as far as Freeland goes, I believe she's Jewish. She is a zealous Zionist. And I don't really take her at face value. I mean, she is a nasty piece of work. Now, Freeland is on the side of Ukraine because that's the side we're supposed to be on. Nobody can say anything good about Russia because Russia has to be demonized. Now, if anybody wanted to look at why Russia attacked at this particular time, well, that would mean we'd have to look back at the scenario, the conditions of the decision-making, what led up to it. And the minute you do that, well, you open a whole can of worms because then you have to look at evidence. And evidence is the last thing that anybody in the narrative spin department wants to talk about. I mean, if you ever look at the history of Russia and Ukraine, Russia has warned the United States over and over not to expand NATO eastward. And in 1990, on July the 3rd, such a promise was made to Boris Yeltsin, who was the predecessor of Vladimir Putin. Since then, I think there's been 18 different countries have been accepted into NATO. The United States outright lied to Russia. It lulled them into a false sense of complacency, I think. Because when the Warsaw Pact was dissolved, you had NATO scooping up these countries because they want to encircle Russia with bases to stop Russia from expanding and forcing it to spend money on weapons. The United States, I think the best way to understand this whole scenario is Sergei Lavrov, who is the Russian foreign minister. He gave a speech at the United Nations, and he stated that the United States will never accept a multipolar world. Because once the Soviet Union died, the bipolar world of Russia, Soviet Union, and the United States sort of morphed into the United States, Russia, China. And all those three countries are strong enough to share, to have an influence on the world economy, the world politics. But America is like an immature little brat child who won't share his toys. So America will not allow anything to interfere with its dominance of world politics. And in this case, it's important to know that throughout its history, Russia has been a staunch advocate and supporter of Arab states in the Middle East. And this is something that the Zionists hate. So the Zionists, even though there are Russian oligarchs in Russia, even though there are oligarchs in Russia that are Jewish, Israel is throwing its weight behind Ukraine, at least rhetorically, because it sees in this a way to undermine Russia. And of course, Israel is very deeply involved in the American corporate culture. So what's good for corporations is good for Israel.
Well, it's one bit of blowback, at least certainly some of the articles I've read have suggested that the Palestinians and particularly Hamas, etc., have been getting arms from fallout from the Ukrainian conflict. There's a lot of arms trade going on, a lot of money available for arms, and some of it getting down there. So anyway, the reason I wanted to chat to you, Greg, is because literally within a week or so of the Russian invasion, back in last year in 2022, 18 months ago or so, you contacted me with some theories to do with connection between the conflict in the Middle East, the Israel-Palestine conflict particularly, and also the war on Ukraine. And
right.
Can you just take us back to that? Because, you know, now obviously the war in Ukraine, I mean, one of the reasons that made me think of you straight away was seeing that the Ukrainians seem to have completely run out of road with the conflict with Russia. Everything seems to have ground to a halt, lack of ammunition, it finding it almost impossible to recruit any young people to fight the Russians, knowing that they're probably just going to die, and also problems getting any more equipment from tanks to get blown up by the Russians. So running out of road completely with this offensive, the summer offensive that never was, and then all of a sudden it sort of kicks off down in the Middle East instead. So I suddenly thought of you. So can you just tell us first of all what you think the connection between the two conflicts is?
Well, one thing is they have one feature in common. The Hamas attack into Israel, the Palestinian attack into Israel, and the Russian attack into Ukraine are both acts of aggression, we can say, that are not causal. They are the result of a long buildup. And what the media is doing, as it's always done and it will continue to do, is to portray these people, the Palestinians and the Russians, as the instigators of violence. And that is a bald-faced lie. Take it, for example, Russia. Since 1990, Russia has been humiliated and frustrated and enraged by the United States' duplicity about not expanding NATO. It's been the single biggest problem between the two countries. And Vladimir Putin has shown amazing forbearance in not attacking earlier, I would say. The Palestinian misery is, of course, well known, except to people who don't want to face it. I would say at least since, 50, 60 odd years, Israel has been torturing, killing, dispossessing, bombing, terrorizing a captive population. These people are civilians. They have no way out. So it would make sense that when they had the material to do something, let's stand up to Israel. Now, they probably knew what they were in for. But at some point, enough is enough. You can't take anymore. And that also drives Putin's reason for going into Ukraine. Everything that has been going on in both those wars can be laid at the feet of the United States because it did nothing to prevent them. It allowed these two instabilities to perpetuate themselves. And since Israel essentially dictates foreign policy to the United States, as I showed in my book, The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America, it is impossible to talk of the United States as an independent country. I'm absolutely ashamed of the American public watching somebody as doddering and vacuous as Joe Biden stand up and give the illusion that he has something useful to say. I've seen dime store mannequins who look more alive than he does. He's a disgrace. He's a sock puppet for interest groups. He doesn't have a brain cell of his own to work with.
But now, I remember one of the things you said was that you thought that actually the Israelis may have encouraged this Zelensky chap in order to get at the Russians, because they felt that the Russians were causing trouble for them down in the Middle East. I mean, this is an interesting idea. I just wonder if there's any real evidence for that.
The thing with Israel is that evidence is very hard to come by because it's very well hidden. Israel gets the United States to do its dirty work for it. But Zelensky, even though he's, I think he's Jewish, he has a Jewish religious background, he shakes hands with the neo-Nazis of the Azov Battalion. There are neo-Nazis in the Ukrainian military. That's an open secret. It's been published even in the mainstream propaganda media. So Israel is supporting that, and Zelensky has come out in support of Israel too. I mean, Israel knows that Zelensky is a good cat's paw to use against Russia, to drag Russia into a war, force Russia to expend resources. And as one former Trump deputy security advisor said, the idea is to bankrupt Russia, which I thought was amazingly arrogant and fatuous. How is the United States going to bankrupt Russia? I mean, for Christ's sakes, America's bankrupt already. But it's interesting to note one thing, though, you see. The Ukraine war, even though it's costing thousands of lives, costing billions upon tens of billions of dollars of military equipment, destroying cities, towns, villages, and whatnot, it's really a sideshow. I mean, it's just a distraction. The main war here is an undeclared war against Russia. The United States, as I said earlier, will not play on an even playing field with Russia and China. It will not share the world's influence, because the United States has never been anything more than an arrogant, overly Christian imperial power, at least since, I would say, post-war.
I mean, this is after I interviewed you last year, but around about April, same sort of time that Boris Johnson was flying over to scupper the peace agreement, potential peace agreement that was brewing between the Russians and Ukrainians.
In the Minsk agreement?
There were talks about an agreement which Boris Johnson went over to whilst he was still prime minister. It was one of his last things he did, was to make sure that there was going to be no peace there. Zelensky actually said he wanted Ukraine to be a big Israel, which is a bizarre thing to say. I mean, peace was reported all around the world, and I think many people looked at that and scratched their heads. He was really talking about turning Ukraine into a security state. So he wants his country to become a big Israel with its own face after the Russian invasion ends.
He's talking about turning Ukraine into a security state. And what this means is that he's going to treat his own public like prisoners. I mean, Ukraine is a bit of an artificial country to begin with. I mean, it was carved out of the former Russian Empire. I mean, Ukraine didn't exist until before World War I. He sees himself as some sort of tin pot dictator. He takes himself far too seriously.
Well, one of the Russians, I remember one of the Russians commentating saying, well, having Zelensky in charge of Ukraine is like getting on an aircraft and there's a guy dressed like a pilot who tells you he's the pilot, but he actually doesn't know how to fly a plane, being in charge of a, you know, of the flight.
That is probably a very good analogy. Zelensky has no qualifications to govern anything. He began his career, if I recall correctly, as a theatrical clown. And now he's got a career as a political clown. And it's the United States and Israel that are pulling the strings, like some little Ukrainian marionette, little kukol, Ukrainsky kukol. And so it's a little bit... it's a little dispiriting watching this imbecile swan around the world and be treated with all the deference of the emperor who has no clothes. And did you ever see Game of Thrones? There's a character called Daenerys Targaryen. She's the daughter of a former king, and her entire arc throughout the entire series of books is she swans around the world, around the area, Westeros, gathering people to form an army to take back the Iron Throne. She just goes around collecting armies, collecting people. That's it. It's not a very interesting character. And we have Zelensky, whose only function in life appears to be walking from country to country, cap in hand, begging for armaments. And finding that people like Justin Trudeau in Canada are too afraid to say no. They want to be seen as being good little pro-American sycophants. So they say, yeah, we'll give you anti-aircraft weaponry or this or that tank or whatnot. And it's kind of interesting that despite all the largesse that the United States, that the world has thrown at Israel, sorry, pardon me, I keep saying Ukraine, I meant to say Ukraine, very little of it has survived. Now, 99 Bradley fighting vehicles were slated for the 47th Armored Division. Ukraine's 47th Mechanized Brigade, sorry. Of those 99, 34 have been damaged, destroyed, or abandoned. Quickly. Of those, 28 were destroyed in one battle. 10 of the 32 German Leopard tanks given to Ukraine are out of commission. 20% of all Western weaponry has been damaged or destroyed. This is by European officials. And what's even more is that for every 100 Ukrainians who signed up for this war, 80 of them are injured or incapacitated or dead. There's almost nothing to constitute an army. This is a phantom army. It's a paper army. And nobody cares about the Israelis because the Ukrainians, God, good grief, Greg, but Ukrainians, because they're just there to draw Russia's attention. Nobody in America cares two pins about the Ukrainians. They're going to fight this war to the last Ukrainian. And I forget who said that, but it was a very good comment.
Now, look, because you've written quite a lot on the Middle East. So can you just give us your take on, where this conflict is likely to go? We're in a bizarre hiatus now. I think it's 5 days after the Hamas attack. And obviously it's horrific to see this loss of life, but one can also understand that there is a ridiculously appalling oppression of people in the prison camp. The other thing is the reaction has been from the Israeli side to do something which is almost unconscionable, which is cut off the water supplies, cut off electricity supplies, cut off food supplies. So the idea, it seems, is to either, it doesn't take long for people to dehydrate if they haven't got any, especially in the Middle East, if they haven't got any water. And it seems as if it's designed to turn everybody who didn't support Hamas in attacking the Israelis to actually mobilize to fight Israel, literally to get their next glass of water and in order to survive. They have to fight the Israelis. So, I mean, what do you make of this kind of halfway house? I mean, obviously, the Israelis have also been bombing flat large areas of Gaza, but there hasn't been a massive armed incursion into the civilian areas by the IDF yet.
No, the occupation force, I refuse to call it a defense force, cannot afford to. And what I think Haaretz came out with a good article that showed Israel is going to pay a terrible price for its ruthless massacre of the Palestinians. I mean, the one thing, see, the great failure of Israel, the consummate failure of its treatment of the Palestinians, is that it's already gone as low as it can go. Torture, murder, starvation, deprivation of employment. It can't do any worse. But the more it goes down that path, it has nothing. There's no upside for Israel. All it can do is kill. That's all it knows. It's a parasitic virus that sucks the life out of the entire human race, and it is infecting Palestine even more than normal. The more it goes, and you're quite right, the more sympathy the Palestinians will gain, despite the dogma and the sycophantic behavior of governments. Already the British government is telling the Football Association to express sympathy for Israel. And how many Muslims are playing in the Premier League? I don't think that's going to happen. Even the European Union, which reflexively cut off aid to the Palestinians, was stood on its ear by the Spanish and the French. And so the EU is having to rethink its anti-Palestinian reaction. Ironically, this might end up benefiting Palestine to some degree, because it just shows the limits of Israeli rhetoric, Israeli propaganda. What we are seeing is the true face of Israel, a cancerous, murderous, illegal occupation state that was never legitimate in the first place. Well, and every country that is going to concoct sophistries to justify Israeli terrorism is going to have to pay a penalty.
Well, look, there's a couple of things here. First of all, it's almost as if the complete failure, and it's, you know, you can draw parallels between the United States' absolute refusal to negotiate with Russia and the Israelis' refusal to negotiate with the Palestinians and with the Arab world generally. The taking of hostages is one way you can actually force negotiations.
Unless, of course, the Israelis are prepared to sacrifice the hostages, because the Israelis really don't even care about Jews. I mean, the Jew is just a unit of utility. I mean, one of the Jewish members of the American government during, I think it was the 1990s, was telling telling Israel just about it might have been about Lebanon, and he was just called a little Jew boy by the Israeli. I mean, Israelis care nothing for humanity. It's almost as like it's like an alien being. They're not even human, the way they treat people.
And they've actually been openly talking about these Palestinians and, you know, Hamas as animals.
Of course they are, because that's all they know. Hatred is what drives a Jew in Israel. Without hatred, Israel has no justification.
Well, hang on a minute, because there's been actually tens of thousands of Jews out on the streets, haven't there, waving banners every Saturday since the new year. With one of the banners that particularly caught my attention said "Crime Minister." The Netanyahu's actually having to try and change the constitution so he doesn't get prosecuted and get sent to jail for corruption.
Right. No, you're quite right that many Jews have, as a matter of fact, most Jews do not support Israel anymore. A lot of the younger Jews particularly are alienated by the abject and unapologetic cruelty inflicted upon Palestine. And what's interesting is I had so many arguments with idiots who get their knickers in a twist whenever I distinguish Jew from Zionist, because I'm very careful to do that. Zionist Jews are the problem, not your garden variety liberal Jew. I had this one idiot named Dennis Fetcho, who I had the misfortune to be interviewed by, and we had a rather testy exchange, but I just found him to be so completely irrational that it was, I should have quit the interview before it ended. And then I had this interview with these Brits, a man named Mark Collett. I don't know if you know him. But he and three other people were interviewing me about my book, ostensibly. And all he could do was rant at me for not blaming the Jews for everything. Well, I would never do that. You don't want to blame every Christian for the mindless behavior of the Catholic Church, or the vacuous fulminations of some evangelical. I mean, Christians are just like any other religious.
Yeah, I mean, there must be many Jews who are thinking to themselves, hang on, this country that, you know, we loved is going down the drain with Netanyahu in charge. In fact, it might be time to get out of Dodge.
Exactly. And this is why the only people that really have time for the Israelis are Zionist Christians. Because these people are psychopathic. They don't give a rat's ass about anybody but Israel and the Bible and Jesus swanning down to, you know, to evaluate the humanity. They're the only people who really care, because the average thinking Jew knows better. And the Israelis know this. They are losing their own religious community. And by the way, Israel is not a Jewish state, despite what people may tell you. For it to be a Jewish state, it would have to be a theocracy, which it isn't, clearly. It's a Jewocracy because Jews run it, but it's not a Jewish state, never has been. And this is part of the propaganda that has been beaten into Western society for decade upon decade upon decade, probably almost for a century. And now we have this whole Israel problem, I think, exploding before the world's eyes.
Greg Felton, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.